Well, hello again, everybody. Am I coming through loud and clear? Can everybody hear me? I should have my man in the chat there. I can see. Yeah, I think we're up and running. Good afternoon there. Well, welcome back to another Morgoths and Endeavours Classic Movies. And today, I think it's fair to say that this is a true classic. It's one of the most requested ones that we've ever had. We get it mentioned. And we are live. There's my man in the chat there. We are live. It's one of the most requested ones we ever get. And it is the absolutely glorious The Man Who Would Be King, with Sean Connery, Christopher Plummer, Michael Caine. And it's directed by John Huston. It's got a soundtrack by Maurice Jarre from the Lawrence of Arabia. And it's based on a book by Rudyard Kipling. So it just oozes classic. Out of its very pores. How are we doing today, Endeavour?
I'm doing great. Sorry, I was just muted for a second, but yeah, I'm doing great. And this is the most requested one that I've ever gotten. Every time we do a stream, I get requests for this one, and it's a fun movie. It's a great adventure film. Has some really interesting themes. As a all-star cast, and it's one that I always enjoy. It's a treasure.
It's got so much heart, hasn't it? It's got so just so much joy, so much great about it. I love it. I hadn't seen it for quite a long time, actually. And I fired it up again yesterday, and it's one of those movies where you just kind of fall into it. And there's just so much to enjoy. It ends and you feel like you've been on this great epic journey. Oh, look at this. So hang on a minute there, folks. Because we've got a guest. This is the first Morgoth and Endeavour Classic Movie stream, and we've got a guest who's fashionably late and had me in a bit of a panic. So we've got Closeton on as well. How are you doing, Closeton?
I'm doing just fine, Morgoth. Glad to be on.
Great. So the reason why we've got Closeton on will become clear late. I mean, he's going to join in the general banter because he loves a movie as well. But there's a few extra layers to Man Who Would Be King, which we'll touch on in a little bit later. So without further ado, I think we shall jump in and I'll give a bit of an outline of the main plot. And feel free to jump in, lads, because it's quite a big one, this one. So what we have is The Man Who Would Be King. We've got Michael Caine and Sean Connery, who are best friends, and they are two ex-soldiers of the British Army in India. They've left the army, and mainly they're roaming around India, getting up to no good, having adventures, conning people, and just generally just living life to the maximum, you could say that. I think they're not particularly interested in, you know, careers and respect and all of that. It's there are two lovable rogues, I think you could say. And they get into a little bit of trouble. Just to get straight to the point, they travel all the way up north with the idea to some country called Kafiristan, which is 10,000 square kilometers long. It's pretty much Afghanistan. And they want to kind of con the people and hoodwink the king and take over, loot the place, and then get the hell out of Dodge City with a ton of loot. So that's the basic pitch of the movie. Of course, there's a lot of other things that I'm struggling to like start even get into it, because they have a few misadventures before the main adventure even begins. And another character in it is Christopher Plummer. And the story is on from Rudyard Kipling. And Christopher Plummer actually plays Rudyard Kipling in the book, in the film. And he's a newspaper. He writes for a newspaper called The Northern Star, I think it is. And so he is kind of like the man who's cataloguing it all and writing down notes. And another facet to all of this is that they're all Freemasons, and that's actually why Clausen. We're going to get into that a little bit later on. There's a strong component of Freemasonry in. So, what would you say on the basic pitch of the film, lads?
So I'll let Clausen can go first, I guess.
I'd rather not go first, but since we addressed the Freemasonry aspect, I was brought on as the resident Freemason to sort of elaborate on the more esoteric and symbolic elements in the actual movie. To the untrained eye, a lot of the scenes are just scenes, but to a Freemason, you know that, you know, the scene where Sean Connery is blinded in the snow is reminiscent of one of the degrees. And you know that the temple is set up like a Freemason lodge, and you know the passwords, and you know the grips that they use. So this movie is probably the most Freemasonic movie ever made, or at least big budget Freemasonic movie ever made, with the layer of a basic liar reveal plot structure, plus a good rise and fall story, good tragedy due to hubris, and very classical themes of brotherhood and virtue.
Well, for me, I admit I am a newbie to the Freemason question. I'm not fully red pilled on it, so to say. But I enjoyed other aspects of the film. I did read up a bit on it in preparation for the stream, but I just love it as like an adventure film. I always love films about the 19th century and about imperialism, the British Empire. And we've already done tons of films. We did Lawrence of Arabia. We did Around the World in 80 Days, 55 Days at Peking, and now we're doing another film like set kind of in that era, late 19th, early 20th century. And it, you know, this like entire time period for me, it just like screams adventure. There's so many great stories that can be written about it. I also just really love the theme of friendship. I really kind of found it like a really poignant and actually moving film in many ways, and something that we can get into this later, but you probably couldn't make today for several reasons. But yeah, it's a fun film. It's a sad film. And an exciting one, all around great film.
Yeah, I mean, on the most basic side of it, what I like is, especially in the early stages when you're introduced to India, is just how alien and sort of mystical and mysterious India looks. We've got all these people doing the, like, it's kind of a cliche, you know, where whenever you go to India, like somebody's sitting there doing one of those little trumpet things to a snake and all of that. It's for some reason there's always smoke in the air. I don't know if it's off all the funeral pyres or whatever it is, but they really like go all in on like, this is a land that you just can't understand. This is a really ancient sort of magical place that a man can lose himself in. I mean, I was reminded of Lawrence of Arabia in some ways with this, because you've got the backdrop of the British Empire, and you've got the sort of the expert professional soldiers meet in like remote wild sort of third world places and all of that.
Yeah, and you even see like the contrast, like you do in Lawrence of Arabia, between the Western modernized military and the kind of more ancient traditional military. So one thing that they're able to take over this place, Kafiristan, because two Englishmen pretty much going to this country, which is pretty much untouched by the modern world at the time. They have a theme in it that the last white man to enter Kafiristan was Alexander the Great. And we can get into this more later, that they think that Sean Connery, Danny, his character is the son of Alexander. That's why they make him the king. But they're able to take over because they basically have modern military tactics against what is at the time pretty much just ancient, probably the same military tactics that they had back when Alexander the Great really was there. It's this like untouched land. But then when the modern military shows up, then they basically just dominate.
Yeah, well, and even when they just train the others in how to fight like the English army, like the British army, they do that thing what they do in Zulu, where like I don't know what make a volley fire, but I don't know if it's got a like a special military name where it's like one row of soldiers is kneeling down and there's a one behind them, like a row behind them are reloading, and then they step forward to fire, and then the ones that were kneeling stand up and reload, and it just kind of goes round and round like that. You see in Zulu, they've got like mountains of dead bodies because of it. It seemed like a really brutal tactic, and it worked to a T for the British Army.
Yeah, and they had brought with them, I think it was like 10 rifles or something like that. 20 rifles. Okay, yeah, they brought 20 rifles with them. And with that, they're able to basically put together a military force that's able to dominate the entire region. I did actually wonder, how are they getting ammunition for them? I mean, I guess maybe they're able to make ammunition. I don't know exactly how it works.
In the books, they explain that they set up foundries and armories to actually produce bullets and very, very primitive rifles for the sort of rank and file troops. That's sort of explained away. In the actual movie, you don't see any more rifles than the 20 Martini rifles that they show up at the beginning.
Yeah, and they even have they even put together a cavalry force as well in the first battle. So when they first get there, they basically swindle a local warlord. So a guy who's ruling over like a small settlement. They tell him that, well, we're going to conquer for you. We're going to we've come here and we're going to help you become the ruler of this land. And he buys into it. He thinks, oh, well, these guys are going to help me defeat my enemies. And I'm going to put them in charge of my army. And they win the first battle. There actually is a funny part where I think it's Peachy. So Michael Caine's character is commanding the riflemen while Sean Connery's character is commanding the artillery. If I have that correct, it might have been the other way around. But the cavalry charges before they're ready, and like there's some confusion, but they're able to win the first battle. And the way that Sean Connery gets proclaimed the king is that he's shot by an arrow, and it hits the leather belt that he has around his like the ammunition belt that he has around his chest. And the people see this and they see that they think that he's been struck by an arrow and he's not bleeding, so therefore he must be immortal, he must be a god, and this is how they came to the conclusion that he's the son of Alexander.
Yeah, and I mean, that comes a bit later on. The first, though, we have to establish, because they travel all the way through India, all the way through the jungles. I mean, I watched it on BitChute, so I was kind of conscious of the time where if I like paused it a couple of times. And it's because it's a long movie, and it's a good solid, like it's more than an hour before they actually get to Kafiristan in the movie. I mean, you've really been through quite a lot with the characters, and I think that's why it's such a great film, because before the main thing takes place of them taking over the kingdom, you've been in their company for a long time and you've been with them through quite a lot before you actually even get to the main plot line, which is great storytelling. And I think another like element of great storytelling, which is probably, Closeton could say if this is in the Kipling book, I think it might be, where when they're on the way, they go through a lot. I mean, Sean Connery goes, he gets snow blindness. You get this scene where they're stuck on the side of a mountain and the snow bridge has collapsed before them and behind them, so they can't get off the side of the mountain. And throughout it all, what they do is they keep like, this is what I mean about great storytelling, because they keep referring to things that have happened to them in the past, which are part of their, which like, they'll tell stories in the movie about some adventure that they got into or some battle that they were in. And there's one point where when they're on their way, first setting off really, I think, and they see that there's some captain of the guard or something standing there on patrol. And they kind of, Sean Connery's like calling his name. So, and the idea is like they know the names of the people in the British military and all of that. And then they start referring to more stories when they're on the go. So the impression this gives you is that, like, they've really been around a lot. But then on top of that, it's as if you hear all of these other stories that they've been on. And so the world feels like it's old and lived in, you know, because it isn't that these are just two men who've kind of, you have to get to know just because of what they're doing on the screen. They're giving you this, it's really clever storyline because it makes them so well fleshed out and so distinctive, so strong characters that you, by the time you get to the main thing in Kafiristan, you feel like they're old friends. And that's the way they speak to each other as well.
One thing that's interesting in the scenes when they're trying to get to Kafiristan, I love the part where there's a map that they're looking at, and Michael Caine's character, Peachy, says that this river on a map, like, they come up to this huge canyon, like this huge canyon with a river at the bottom. They're trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to get over that? And he just says, on a map, it's just a little blue line, but in real life, it's actually quite daunting. I do like the adventure to Kafiristan. That's like almost as interesting as the second half of the film. I will say that probably one of my favorite scenes, maybe even my favorite scene in the entire movie, is when they're in the mountains. So they're hiking through these mountains. It's absolutely like what's the right word? It's punishing. Like there's all this snow. Sean Connery has snow blindness. The ice bridge that they cross collapses behind them, and there's a point where they basically think that, okay, we're finished, we're gonna die here. They're on the side of a mountain and they're resting with a fire, but they realize that there's no way to go back and there's no way to go forward, and they pretty much are saying, well, I think this is as far as we ever made it. I think it was Michael Caine that they were saying, well, we might not have been very good men, you know, but we may have been scoundrels, but how many men out there have seen what we've seen in our lives? And I think Sean Connery says, well, not very many of them. And this scene, like, they both think that this is it and they're going to die now. And I thought that, you know, prior to the 19th century, there would have been very few people in the world who would have seen that, as much of the world as they would have seen in their years in service and all their adventures together. And I also would posit that, you know, today maybe people would have seen more of the world, but in many ways they really wouldn't have, because people can't go on adventures like that anymore. You go to one of these countries and it already has like a tourism industry. It already has all the modern stuff. It has a McDonald's here and there. There's Coca-Cola. There's these hotels and stuff like that. You know, it might still have like the Indian temple, but it's, you know, it's not as untouched and majestic and just there to be discovered like it would have been in the 19th century. And I find the scene so moving is when they're basically reminiscing of their old stories, when they're on the side of the mountain, they think that, you know, this is it, they're gonna die. And then they tell a story and they're laughing. They laugh so hard at this. They laugh so hard at the story that it causes an avalanche and the snow comes down and then basically creates a bridge that they can walk over and cross the mountains. I just love that scene. That scene where they're there and they think it's the end and they're reminiscing over all the great times they had together and they laugh so hard that it causes an avalanche and that's how they get out of it. It's a great scene about friendship and brotherhood.
I mean, one element of the movie, which is why it wouldn't get made today, is like white supremacists. They are, it isn't a very sympathetic view of people from that part of the world. And there's a scene at the start where on the train where Michael Caine runs into Christopher Plummer for the first time, and there's an Indian fella gets on and he's one of the funny things about some of the Indians is that they try to speak like the kind of upper class English or the English army officers would. And so it comes across kind of comical. But Michael Caine, like, he does treat them like shit. And then eventually just throws them through the door. And then there's a few other elements to it, the way the natives are depicted, which just wouldn't fly. I mean, the famous line, and I posted it on Telegram yesterday. I mean, I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but when he says that Utah, is it? He's like the local chieftain, and he's like a total retard. And he says, "Are you gods?" Like the Billy Fish comes in. We'll get into all this more in depth. The point is, though, Michael Caine comes out with that line, says, "We're not gods, we're Englishmen," which is the next best thing. And even you, and it's just such a great line. And then Utah is like, he's saying, like, Billy Fish is a Gurkha who can, he's basically just there to translate, but he's a good character in his own right. I mean, even the Gurkhas are like, in English, sort of the history of the British Empire, the Gurkhas are themselves like quite interesting. They've got their own thing. And eventually it's like Sean Connery's like, Billy Fish says, "Well, I've told them that you doff your hats to the women's and you give dogs names and you march like left, right, left, right, left, right." And Sean Connery's like, "Yes, indeed, bringing light, enlightenment to the darkened part of the world." Would that bringing enlightenment to the world, is that part of masonry, Freemasonry, Closington? If you say I'm bringing enlightenment to the world and that kind of thing?
I think that's more of a British attitude than an actual Masonic attitude.
Yeah.
Like on the aspect of like these are such savage peoples and this wouldn't be made today. The book is a lot more harsh on the racial aspects. Like in the movie, the Kafiristan is basically Afghanistan, but in the book, it's basically Bactria, this white ethno state just north of Afghanistan, but south of Kunduz. And he said, I'm pretty sure Danny says these aren't slur starting with N, they're English. And then they start actually rising, the chiefs and the high priests to the third degree. So it's like the idea is that the Kafiris are actually long lost, a long lost tribe of white people, and Danny's long term scheme is to create an empire like the British Empire, and suppressing the quote unquote Black Mohammedans and all of the other tribes. But you know, there's of course the fall due to hubris,
There's something else we should bring up. Were you finished, Closington?
Yeah, I'm finished.
Yeah, because it was along the lines of the Mason question. So Morgoth mentioned that there's a scene at the beginning where Michael Caine's character throws the Indian guy off the train, and the reason for that is actually quite interesting. That him and Sean Connery's character, they're scoundrels, they're swindlers, they're thieves. They're always trying to scam people. Michael Caine's character pickpockets Rudyard Kipling. He steals his pocket watch, and then he looks at it and he realizes that he's a Freemason. And then when they're on the train, he tries to find a way to put the watch back in Kipling's pocket, because he realizes he just stole from another Mason, and that's against like their code. And he frames the Indian guy. He frames the Indian guy for stealing the watch from Kipling, and he throws him off the train for that. And then he says, "I think Kipling says something. Well, I actually didn't have my watch, and I had lost my watch before I got on the train." And then Michael Caine says, "Well, back then I didn't know you were a Mason." So he returns him the watch, which I think Closington might have some more to add on this. But what I thought was interesting is that Danny and Peachy, they're both these swindlers, they're these scam artists, they're not very moral people, but they do still hold true to this code that you can't betray another Mason. So even though they're willing to steal, they're willing to cheat people, they won't do it to another Mason. That's kind of like the morality, that's like the line too far, which is interesting that even the thieves might have like that kind of morality.
The sort of basic, like I should probably clarify what Kipling's experience with masonry is and what it was in practice in colonial India. So what masonry is, like if you go down your main street and you see a lodge, it's what's referred to as a blue lodge, where you are raised to three different degrees to become a master mason. After that, you have to make, you know, various secret oaths, anger, you know, Catholics and evangelical prots. But after you become a third degree mason, you have to make oaths of brotherhood, you know, refer to other masons as brothers, be an honest person. In the Anglosphere, you have to believe in God. If you are an embarrassment to the lodge, you'll get kicked out. So there's a certain self-selection and a conversation starter, plus a vow of honesty amongst your brothers. The more conspiratorial minded people, you know, in terms of actual blue lodges that that Kipling and I'm involved with, are clubs where you can find camaraderie. And in India, Kipling was able to meet, you know, like Hindus and Muslims and upper ranking officers and low class laborers under the same roof without having the obligation of paying homage to rank or social class. And that is, you know, the cement that lays the sort of brotherhood that you see in the film. So Kipling is a third degree Mason. He's a master Mason. Danny and Peachy are both Mason, third degree Masons. It's obvious that that Billy Fish is a second degree Mason, just by a handshake that you might see in the film if you have a close eye. And the idea is you stick by your brothers, and in a world of chaos and you know, you don't know anyone else, but you do know that they're Masons. So it's just a sort of brotherhood without borders. It's a fraternity.
Yeah. So somebody in the chat says, why doesn't Morgoth ever talk about the Masons? Well, I don't really know very much about it. I've just got the like a really basic grasp of what it's all about. I'm not in the Masons. I've never been invited to the Masons. I think I'm too working class for that. So that's why I've got Closenton on, because he does know more about it. But I mean, I don't want to get too off track, but I can kind of see how people would see it was subversive if there's a universal element to it. And it's like you're a British officer and then you're running a newspaper and then you are regarding, like, say, Indians and people from around the world as your brother rather than your own so kin or nation. Like, I can see why that's going to rile people up the wrong way, to be honest.
Yeah, but let's not forget that. Let's not forget that we had people like Kipling or even the first Prime Minister of Canada, John A. Macdonald, as Freemasons. So it's not like there weren't guys who were based in Red Pill in that organization.
Like some people in the chat say that like the higher tier degrees are more occultic. Like the first three degrees are mostly allegorical. And the point of them is, you know, you belong to a fraternity, don't betray your frat brothers. Everything else, you know, Scottish Rite, Alfred Pike stuff, you know, you can get into esoterica if you really want to, or you could go down the Knights Templar route and Chivalry, Ramsey. But that's all sort of filler. The point of masonry is, you know, your local lodge camaraderie. Everything else, like you can be like a Knights Templar, a commandery, or you could be a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Mason. But at the end of the day, you're still like only up until the third degree that really counts. Like there's nothing really above it. All that's there is brotherhood, plus, you know, extra titles that were developed in France.
I mean, Right, so to get back to the film, it'll be interesting because I'll go through what happens. We've kind of covered the journey briefly. We can get back on all this stuff a bit later on. But so we've arrived in Kafiristan, and they begin to, first of all, they find one tribe which is being attacked by another tribe. It is just like barbarism, let's be honest. It's a total dump. The people are deliberately depicted as dumb and backward. And then they train one tribe to fight in the style of the British Army, and then they easily wipe out or beat, let's say, another tribe. And then the idea is they're going to find common cause with all of them until all of the different tribes are becoming more and more unified under like Sean Connery. And what happens is Sean Connery gets shot with an arrow. And it lands in his bandolier thing, and he doesn't die. So all of these kind of primitives, they don't understand this. So they think he's supernatural or God or something like that. And they decide to play on this and go along with it because it would be easier for them to manipulate and control all of these tribes if they think that Sean Connery is supernatural. So it turns out the story which comes is it is that he is the son. So Alexander the Great passed through that area thousands of years ago and left, and but he left like a big city behind. And so it comes out that they think that Sean Connery is the son of Alexander, returned. And so they all, and then there's like these holy men in it. I think they are interesting in and of themselves because of the like massive amount of respect that they get off all of these primitives. Like they seem to be sovereign, the holy men. They seem to be above all of the tribal leaders and everything, which is kind of interesting. In stark contrast to the British Empire, where it's mainly like banks and bureaucrats. Michael Caine makes a sort of a speech at the start that he laments that it's like the British Empire is just turning into this bureaucratic monstrosity. And it's the bureaucrats that are running India now. It's hard to have an adventure and all of this kind of thing. So let's just take it there then. So is the actual what they're doing, like, is that in line with Masonry? The idea that they are, because it is like they are forming a kind of universal brotherhood or a through uniting all the tribes.
That's it's more of a practical thing in the books. In the movie, they're just raiders. Like, they just want to loot the country for money. They just want to loot the country for money. But in the books, or in the book, they my
All right,
mic's
just
malfunctioning.
sort
One
that out.
second.
Oh, there you go. You're all right now.
In the book, Peachy and Danny actually create their own Grand Lodge for Kafiristan and create create an actual lodge in the temple, and they assign officers and raise master masons. In the movie, it's much more, we're here to raid. In the book, I noticed that Kipling does not have very many good comments about the actual natives, the native administrators of India. In the book, Kipling says that, well, Kipling self-insert character, who's just Kipling. He says that the native kingdoms, so long as they do not commit too much oppression or let too much crime slip, they can do whatever they want. But the bureaucrats will kind of run India as a status quo, like, we'll keep the roads and the trains running, just we won't actually extract any wealth. But Peachy and Danny want to extract more wealth. They said, we can extract 10 times the amount of wealth that the bureaucrats would are extracting if we were in charge. So let's go to a place where there are no firearms and no bureaucrats. so we can actually build a proper kingdom.
Yeah.
So it's less Masonic and more just imperialist.
Yeah. Oh, everything about it is completely unapologetic about the fact of the British Empire. There's no guilt whatsoever. There's one throwaway line of Sean Connery where there's a bit of irony there. I mean, even the line about we're not gods, we're Englishmen, even that has a kind of tongue-in-cheek sort of element to it. And then when they're training the tribesmen how to fight like a modern army, Sean Connery says, they've got this really great way of saying things as well. But Sean Connery says, like, we're going to treat you how to kill your enemies. We'll teach you how to slaughter like civilized men, which there's a bit of an in joke there. There's a bit of like irony, you know?
Yeah. What I wanted to add was I do like the part after the first battle. So this is when Sean Connery gets struck by the arrow, and they now think he's the god. They think he can't be killed. He's the son of Alexander. And this battle, they go into battle basically with the forces of that first settlement they come across, where the leader's a complete moron. And they told him, oh, we're going to help you defeat your enemies. So after the battle, this guy, he wants to decapitate the chief or the ruler of the other settlement that they've now conquered. And this is basically the scene where they just like push him aside and say, okay, no, you're not in charge anymore. We are now. And both the forces who they brought with them and the ones who they've just conquered, they basically say, yeah, these two guys are the rulers now. This idiot who we had in command of our former settlement, he's not in charge anymore. And Sean Connery prevents him from executing his rival. And now and that from then on, that's when he's declared the king. That's when that's kind of the scene where he becomes the king. I just love the part where the guy, like the scene where he thinks he's still in charge. And then everyone around him, all the men there, just realize, okay, no, it's these guys who are really in charge here.
I really like the addition of the concept of the arrow and how he does not bleed, therefore he is the heir of Alexander. This actually wasn't in the book, and I actually really appreciated the sort of characterization that they did. In the book, they take out some bandits and they have knowledge of the third degree. The high priests only had knowledge of up to the second degree. Alexander the Great was a Mason, yada, 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 lost tribe of Greeks, whatever. But I appreciate the characterization. You really don't get much of a, you really don't see too much of Peachy or Danny's personalities until things go wrong. In the movie, you actually see Danny's ego get fed very, very early on. Like in the book, they rise because they are superior Masons and because they have guns. But in the movie, you actually see, you know, a so-called miracle, and the people are a lot more suspicious and look a lot like what they would look like in Afghanistan. And you actually see conflict between Danny and Peachy. Like, Danny and Peachy in the book don't actually go at each other's heads until after the fall. So I really appreciate Danny's ego being fed, you know, through this god mythos. I also note that that towards the end, Danny says, you know, I am king, when the contract of celibacy and swearing off alcohol is brought up. But in the book, Danny says, we are kings. So it's very, very obvious in the movie that Danny is becoming megalomaniacal. In the book, it's much less apparent.
So there's a theme that they basically swear an oath, or is it some kind of contract that they will abstain from women and alcohol until they've returned. with the riches.
It's until they're both kings.
Until they're both kings, yes. When Danny gets to after the battle and after he's declared that he's the son of Alexander, there's a woman named Roxanne who I don't know if this is true. According to the movie, that was the name of Alexander's wife. So he thinks that like it's destiny that she must be his wife as well, because Alexander had that wife, and now he's king and he's been declared his heir. And that's kind of where they break their vows. So they break their vows of celibacy and sobriety. And that kind of like is where their downfall kind of begins. So his downfall begins when he kind of loses, when he kind of starts to believe the lies that he told. Kind of like he's a swindler who starts to believe his own fraud. And I believe that he even at some point starts to say, "Well, yeah, I actually am the son of Alexander. It's no fluke. I actually am." And a lot of times, what you see with a lot of it's relevant today. Not that we need to get into it too much, but con artists, liars, or cheats, or you know, the elites in the West today. A lot of times when they push a lie, they get to a point where they start to believe it themselves, where they start to like buy their own bullshit, and that's often when their downfall it becomes imminent. So a lot of scam artists out there who are like trying to sell you some get rich quick scheme, for example, a lot of them get to the point where they actually genuinely believe that they're not scam artists. They're actually bringing something great to the world. And I think that that's kind of what's happened today. I think a lot of the elites today have actually bought into their own, lies. A lot of them genuinely believe this just because of this like feedback loop. And I think that's kind of what happens with Danny in this film, is that they go in there, to swindle the people and to become kings, and they realize that, well, if they think I'm the son of Alexander, well, then I can easily become king. This is our ticket to power. But then when he actually gets in, it kind of goes to his head, and he starts to actually believe his own bullshit, and that's kind of when his downfall begins.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a bit of a bump, because the holy priests tell them to go to the city. What's the city called? Anaxandria?
It's Secundergul.
Secundergul. And so this is the city that was built by Alexander. And now the high priest, he doesn't really believe in this. So they get the gold, they get the arrow that Sean Connery's been walking around with, and it's like, well, let's open your chest and try this again. Now we're just going to shoot you straight into the chest and see if you survive it. And he's just about to do it, and then he sees the Masonic what is it called? Necklace.
It's a square and compasses and an all-seeing eye.
Yeah, so he got that off Christopher Plummer earlier at the beginning of the film. And so then they've got this, it's basically a symbol that's known to them through Alexander. It's on some kind of coffin thing. I don't know what you'd call it.
It's like a hidden tablet that only the highest priests know of.
Well, that
which is like anachronistic.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the square and compasses weren't really a symbol until like the 1780s. But, you know, Alexander was a Mason, yada, yada, yada. But the point is, Sean Connery has this Masonic symbol that Alexander the Great knew of, and it's a secret that that only the high priest knew of. Wow, this confirms that he really is the son of Alexander. How would he have known this?
Yeah, so then it's like he is what he says he is. They have to go along with that. And on the subject, though, so Peachy's like in it for the grift. That never really changes, and it puts a lot of strain on their friendship, because he just wants to get all the loot and get out and live like a king, but back in England, say. And Sean Connery's like, well, no, because as Endeavour was saying, it starts to go to his head. But like objectively looking at it, Sean Connery is actually making improvements to the country, really. He has big plans, and he's kind of applying the thinking, like the sort of administrative thinking that you'd find in the British Empire, or just in Britain in general, in the homeland. And he's kind of applying that to the running of, he's making things more efficient and trying to kind of, where they've got to start and bring grain in, and 10% of their grain comes to the city, so that if one farm has problems, they can survive, and all of this kind of thing. So again, it is like this supremacist kind of attitude, where it's not just because they think he's a god, but just like, objectively, he's bringing civilization to them, as he said he would. I mean, I think like life under his rule would have been better than what they had, to be honest.
Well, they are the administrators that they were fleeing, like in a certain way.
Yeah, it is. They turn into he turns into a sort of bureaucrat.
I mean, it's reminiscent of Rudyard Kipling's other poem, The White Man's Burden, that, you know, in the 19th century, early 20th century, there was this idea that kind of the European man had this duty to go around the world and to bring civilization to all the unenlightened places which are stuck in the Dark Ages. When they find themselves to be the only European men in this untouched kingdom where the modern world is completely unknown, they end up actually bringing the modern world with them in many degrees, even though they there is like this irony in the entire film that like they helped conquer India. They were soldiers in the British Army, and they helped conquer India. But now they're lamenting that it's too bureaucratic, that there isn't the same like opportunities for adventure and plunder that there would have been before the British had conquered it, that the modern world has kind of like made its way with them. But then when they go off and then become the rulers of Kafiristan, it's kind of actually the same process, that with them they do bring like the modernization, the bureaucracy that which they actually lamented back in the British Raj.
I think it's sort of poetic that the men can bring civilization to the untamed parts of the world, but they can never marry and they can never have heirs. So, you know, the British might colonize India, but they can never be the true kings of India. They can never have true heirs because it's not Britain.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think when he decides that he wants to marry Roxanne, and he demands that Roxanne gets brought to the city so that he can marry her. And this is where things, I think, really begin to go wrong, because the local custom is that if a woman marries a god and has sex with a god, then she'll just be sort of, she'll go up in flame. Yeah, can you hear me okay? What's wrong?
You cut out.
Oh, I was just saying that so in the local kind of tradition, they're saying that if a woman marries a god, because obviously they think he's a god, and then she'll just burst into flames. Now this is where things really begin to strain. This is where things begin to get a little bit dark. Because Sean Connery kind of oversteps the mark, and he's like, "Well, no, I want to marry the woman." Like, because at the end of the day, he is just a man. He's just faking it, so he wants the woman. And the priests and the rest of them are like, "Well, you can't. You're just going to kill her. This is not how things are done." And they actually appeal to like an even higher god, who is sort of watching things unfold, and not being very impressed with what's happening. And the way, just in terms of the way the film's made, it does get really creepy, because you can hear all of these women doing this kind of wailing noises in the background, and there's like smoke there, and there's their reports that the cattle are dying in the fields and that there's famine coming to the land. And see, it's kind of like it's all gone to hell because he's lied, even though it's as if there's a supernatural force at play, like, after all. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is interesting that, you know, it's a society that is that holds mythology in such a high regard. So what people might not realize is that when they get to this temple, they have all these treasures there, which they show Sean Connery and Michael Caine. And this is stuff that's been like kept for thousands and thousands of years, supposedly, because they've still kept the myth of Alexander alive, like this European man who was there 2000 years ago. And that's something they still have great reverence for. And they've kept all of these treasures for when he arrives again. They comment to each other that if we bring these rubies back, we'll be the richest men in all of England. It's interesting that like it's this kind of like religious, it's this deeply religious, very spiritual, superstitious society. But then even then when there is like this swindler, when they do get swindled, it does actually seem to go bad. Like it maybe in some ways, like their traditions actually were able to, kind of defend them from that in some ways, that like the swindler eventually kind of got, what their traditions would have happened.
Kind of similar to this idea, like Alexander is depicted as sort of the sort of proto-British imperialist, except he was smart enough to get out when he was ahead, right? He spread his wild oats. He created Alexandria in Afghanistan. He created a cult around him, and then he said, "I'll leave, but I'll come back." You know, presumably so that some new imperial power, some new civilization in the future will come back and do the exact same thing. Bring order, and then cast a great shadow into the future. But these two weren't smart enough to actually get out when they were ahead.
Yeah, and Alexander did actually marry Roxanne. It was it's been a long time since I read up on it, but I think it was some sort of peace brokering thing, uniting the tribes of that area or something like that. I mean,
that's what it was in the book.
Like, yeah.
In the movie, you know, it's a coincidence that this woman's name is Roxanne, and it's like a marriage of fate and destiny. But in the book, Danny is like, "All right, chiefs, I want to marry into you. So bring to me, like, among the priests, select, you know, the most fine woman of the best heritage, and bring her to me so I can marry her." So there's a lot more Alexander parallelism there.
Yeah, there's also this theme, which in the movie, which actually has played out a few times in history. It's of some like primitive people thinking that Europeans were gods, but then eventually they realize that they're not gods, and then they turn on them. That's actually how James Cook, the captain of the HMS Endeavour, that's actually how he died. Though he wasn't on, he was sailing a different ship at the time. He went to Hawaii. So on his third voyage around the world, basically they weren't doing too well. And they made a stop in Hawaii, and the native people of Hawaii thought that James Cook was a god. And they basically treated him to all these festivities and stuff. But then they left, but then they had to come back because there was problems with their ship. And they realized then that, they then came to the conclusion he actually isn't a god. And he was killed on Hawaii, and never made it back to England alive. So that's something that actually like has happened throughout history. I'm wondering, I'm sure that there are other examples of that, but that's, you know, it's not something that's completely, fictional.
I think it's the arc of Europeans just in the world. Because you could go back to if you go to the height of the British Empire, like exactly when Man Who Would Be King is set, because it would have been like that. They would have seemed like a higher kind of human being, whether leaving aside that it's a sort of contrick in the film, just the level of organization and the level and the drive and all the rest of it would have seemed to these people to be just completely from a different world. So in a way, they would have appeared like gods. And then you get into the after World War II, then there's this massive, even World War I as well, to be honest. But in terms of European identity relative to others, it's after World War II when that really comes in because of issues we can't talk about on YouTube. I think in World War I, there's a loss of confidence relative to our place in the world with what we've done and what the civilization has become, with technology and everything. There's a sort of spiritual loss. But then after World War II, I think it becomes more racialized because of certain issues. And then it's kind of the descent keeps going. So you get this kind of, in the eyes of the world, the European man gets demystified after World War II. But then I think that process just keeps carrying on. To now, it's we're not so much sort of gods in a positive light, but we're becoming demonized all of the time. So it's gone almost in another direction.
I don't necessarily think that's true post-World War II. I think the era of old school colonialism and imperialism is dead. But we have a different system now where we have a much more Rothschild's approach where, if you control the bank, you control a third world country's debt, do you actually really care if you have a colonial administrator or if the locals administrate themselves, so long as per the book, not too much oppression and not too much crime? I think the imperialism that we have today is a lot more, it's financialized and not actually on the level of, send two guys to uplift the natives.
I'm talking about how other people around the world view us and how we view ourselves, not how capitalism is financed.
Yeah, and what I wanted to add on is that today what you see is kind of that the West is now seen by people around the world as this land just to plunder. Basically, they're they've lost their respect for Western man and European civilization, and it's just now this big it's just this big money pot which everyone can rush in and grab their and grab their share. There's this whole grift industry today of all these activists, the skintellectual, which Morgoth coined the term, basically that it's basically just these groups that are just rushing in. There's the refugees coming in, and then the higher class ones who are trying to intellectualize it all, and the political actors. And now it's kind of just looting what used to be the envy of the world. Now it's just being plundered.
Somebody in the chat says, where is it? Panjarit Singh, European identity during World War I. This is a fundamental misunderstanding. European identity is new and contrived. No, it isn't. That's a stupid thing to say. What we had is we shared, we went to war all of the time, but it's all within the same civilization. It was all Christian. We were all at more or less the same levels of technology. So when we threw it all together at each other in World War I, we didn't really understand what we'd created. So the obvious example of that would be trench warfare, which was never thought would happen. People went in on cavalry and all of that. And so what we got was the mass slaughter of Europeans by Europeans within Europe, our Europe. So it was this deeply traumatic thing. And the European identity was it had been forged a long, long time before that. I mean, I don't know what to say. There's been a common European identity for more than 1,000 years. That doesn't mean that we don't go to war with each other and things like that.
And there has always been a difference between going to war, France going to war with Germany and France going off and fighting some guys in, Senegal or something like that. That's always been that's always been different. And then the nature of the warfare was completely different. When France and Germany went to war, in the first World War, it was absolutely hell for both of them for years and years, for 4 years. But then, like, the battles in against, like, these tribes in, say, Senegal or something like that, like, the Europeans almost always won. There's a couple examples here and there of, like, European forces being defeated by natives in Africa or Asia or wherever. But pretty much, like, before World War One, we pretty much thought of ourselves as invincible. Like, when the Japanese defeated the Russians in 1905, that was actually, like, really shocking for a lot of people in Europe, because that was the first time that Europeans, Russians, had lost a modern war to an Asiatic power. Now, at the time, Japan had actually gone through decades of modernization, and it was not like fighting, you know, some tribe in somewhere in Africa. Like, Japan had a modern military at the time, but it was seen as like the first time when, you know, we're not actually as invincible as we might have been in decades prior.
I mean, just to get back to the film, because we're reaching like the end, of close to the end. So it all goes to hell. It all goes tits up. And I really love the bit where Sean Connery marches out onto the bridge, which Peachy Michael Caine built, because they've got to keep them. This is another like sort of thing of the British Empire where it's like, keep everybody busy, just build stuff. What if just do stuff? You see it in like Bridge over the River Kwai when it's like, you've got to keep the men busy. And if we're going to build a bridge, then it's going to be the best bridge in Asia. So there's this just supreme confidence, which in like how the British can do things, build things, conquer things, go to places. But anyway, Sean Connery goes out in the middle of the bridge and he starts to sing that hymn, which is part of the great theme tune. And they begin to hack away at the ropes. And I think it's kind of symbolic of what they're doing, because they've been offered this kind of, the bridge is like a symbol of like the modern world, and, you know, and their way, the bureaucrats organizing things for them. And they've decided to like just hack through it with the king himself on the bridge, and he's singing the hymn. And just as he's about to go, when he falls, well, Michael Caine joins in the singing with him. And then when he falls, like, Michael Caine deliberately emphasizes the part of the hymn at the end. And I'll actually, the hymn's quite good. It's a glorious band, the chosen few on whom the spirit came, 12 valiant saints, their hope they knew, and mocked the cross and flame. They met the tyrant's brandished steel, the lion's gory mane. They bowed their hands, the death to feel, who follows in their train. And Michael Caine like really emphasizes the who follows in their train, because they've got this thing between the two of them about sort of following each other around. It's like a running thing where when Sean Connery went blind and he had to hold onto the tail of the donkey or the mule or whatever it was, and then he actually accuses of Michael Caine that like he that Sean Connery's been the one who was leading and this kind of, so it's a sort of running theme. And I just thought it was really touching that he, like, one last time, as Danny fell, he brought it up. He brings it up again when he brings Danny's head back to Rudyard Kipling as well. That he never let go of it, because it took Peachy like 3 years to get back to where they began or something like that. And he also got crucified. And throughout it all, he never let go of his friend's head. It seems like a bit of a macabre thing to carry around for 3 years, but there you go. It certainly adds a poetic element to the story.
Yeah, he still kept the crown. When he brought it back to Kipling, it still had the crown on.
Yeah,
on the head.
Yeah, he did. It's like he did it. We did it. We did like this wild, crazy thing. We actually pulled it off.
Yeah, that scene, it's really moving. I just love the theme of friendship in the movie. Like, Michael Caine and Sean Connery they have perfect chemistry. They're great together, and, you know, they're just, in this film, Danny and Peachy, they're just friends to the end. And, you know, it's something really beautiful. And, you know, it's something that we can't have in movies today, because it's something that we've really lost, because what you'd get today, inevitably, and I can't stand this, is that what people would say is that it meant that they were homosexual. Like, that there's this kind of this undermining of male fraternity, that, well, if two men have this kind of like bond, then they must be gay, which is complete nonsense. But it's something that's you know that's really old. This kind of male fraternity, you know, the Freemasons were an example of that. And I just really love that theme of male brotherhood. It really makes the film pretty.
I mean, you can kind of compare the sort of brotherly love of Masonry and between Danny and Peachy to something like Al Pacino in Scarface, where Pacino is the obvious leader, and he, you know, he's got a friend, but his friend can kind of go by the wayside and he'll murder him in the end. But in this, it's much more of a tragedy because they were actually fraternal with each other. They did actually treat each other like brothers until, I mean, in the movie, it's obvious that Danny crossed a line and no longer treated Peachy like his brother. But in the book, they did actually stick to each other to the end.
Well, I mean, even in the movie, Danny kind of repents. It's all over, they're completely surrounded, and the only thing on Danny's mind is, I can't remember how he puts it, but it's basically, I let us into this bloody mess, and it's all my fault, and, you know, do you forgive me? And then Peachy's basically like, yeah, don't worry about it, like, shit happens. And they're literally going to die, and then Danny, Sean Connery's like, oh, well, that's settled then. There's no problem. It was similar to when they were trapped on the mountain. And it was like, Danny says, like, I don't want to die slowly with the frost slowly creeping up my bones. And Peachy says, well, when the time comes, I'll do what's necessary. Meaning he's going to shoot them both so they don't just die a horrible, painful death. And so they are completely... It's weird because they're really full of life, but they're not scared of death at all. I mean, even on Danny's on the bridge at the end, he's singing there, and he comes out with this line, and he screams over to all of the priests and the tribes people, like cutting away at the ropes, and he's going, "Cut, you buggers, cut!" And it's basically like, just get on with it. Like, you gotta admire that kind of balls. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like, we're talking about how crap things are in movies, but it is like a sort of great masculine ideal. I mean, now it would be like a gay love story, but earlier on as well, when they first arrive there, I think when they first, basically when they first get control of the first tribe, they're offering them all these things. Do you want women? Do you want treasure? Do you want this drink? And they say, no, we're not going to go near the women until we've vanquished all of your enemies. We've got the contract. And the tribal leader, who's like a little pervert moron, he just doesn't understand this at all. And he says, like, well, how about a boy? Would you like to have boys? And Michael Caine, like, literally spits his drink out. And he says, like, these people are bloody savages. And Sean Connery turns around and says, well, you know, it's like foreign people and foreign customs. Live and let live. This is just the way it is. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Two different points. Towards the end, when Danny is executed, they actually did our boy Billy Fish bad. Like in the book, Billy Fish was made into a chieftain and raised to the third degree Mason so that he is equal among his brothers. And then at the end, he's given the opportunity to desert, but he doesn't. He sticks by their side to the end, and he has his throat cut. In the movie, he just does like a suicidal, like sort of a last stand, which I thought was a little bit disrespectful to the character.
Yeah, I think in terms of narrative, at that point, they just needed rid of Billy the Fish because they wanted to have that moment at the end with Peachy singing and Danny on the bridge. It had to be just them two. I mean, even all of their soldiers, they all just kind of disappeared. They all got very easily wiped out, even though they all had guns. And it was as if it was a bit of a rush from John Huston just to get to the point where, like, from his perspective, like, they've actually got a small army and like Billy the Fish, And it's like, well, we need to get rid of all these people so we can have the power. We need just them having a powerful scene together at the end. So it was like, well, what do we do with Billy Fish? And it's, well, let's make him do some kind of suicide run for no real reason at all. Especially when Peachy, like, said, there's still like a mule with some gold on, like, get yourself on it and get out of here. And for no reason, he just runs into the, yeah. So I can kind of see, just in terms of filmmaking, like how what they were trying to do there, you know. One thing that I wanted to touch on as well, and I posted this on Telegram this morning, was the beautiful music, like these brass bands. And I think what I noticed about a lot of these kinds of films, Lawrence of Arabia would be another one, is because the British military brass band, and it's got a strong association with Yorkshire, it kind of conjures up this feeling of like home and the familiar and England. And then what they do in a lot of these epics, where you'll say you'll be in the sands of Arabia or building a bridge across the River Kwai, or in this case, it's like traversing the wastes of Afghanistan or the jungles of India. They mix up the local sort of music that they've got, and they mix it up with this like brass band. And why? I noticed it just listening to the soundtrack, and I thought it's really powerful because you get that sense of Englishness and home, but they're in this place which is completely foreign and unknowable in a way. So you get this feeling that they are really, really far away from home, because of that contrast that they've put in there. And I think it's really effective. And I think the brass band in general is like you know, in terms of British patriotism and everything, we've just had the Queen's Jubilee. And I think the brass band in general is like a really neglected part of all of this kind of patriotic identity of Britain, maybe because it is so strongly associated with the empire. But it's something that I'm interested in. I mean, a while ago, I came across this. I came across, there's a pit village up in Northumberland, and they were having like a memorial for a mining. Like, there was a mining disaster there about 100 years ago, and a lot of people died. And they had the brass band playing, and there was a vicar giving us like a sermon and talking to them. And I just thought it was the most beautiful thing I'd seen for so long. I didn't even know people did that kind of thing anymore. I think I'm going to do something on that, actually, a video or a Substack or something.
Like, what I really appreciate is the sort of juxtaposition of this beautiful British patriotic music to the absolutely ugly and discordant native music.
Yeah.
Like, I think they went out of their way to make sure that, you know, you had a kid screeching there. You had like an annoying trumpet and annoying horn there. This is compared to the camaraderie that is inspired by the actual British music and the hymns that they actually sing.
Yeah, I really love the soundtrack too. I don't know if I have much more to add, but yeah, it does really just like add to the adventure, and the hymn that they sing at the end, it's perfect. I just love that scene.
Right, so I think I'm going to hit the super chaps. Then, have you got anything more to say on the Masonic element of it, Closington, or are we ready to hit the super chats?
Well, there are too many like little nods here and there to actually name. Like, I could mention that that Danny's the scene where he judges the different cases is reminiscent of King Solomon. Like, of course, the temple has the checkerboard floor and the two pillars. Like, of course, you see like symbols here and there, passcodes here and there. But that just, it's more of an aesthetic. I'd say that compared to the book, it has a much more Alexander the Great aesthetic than like a Masonic aesthetic. I could say that.
The part about Alexander, can I just ask, I didn't know this when I was watching the movie, the part about Alexander being like a Mason allegedly, is that just storytelling, or is there anything like any like background to that?
It's completely bunk. Like as I said earlier, like the square encompasses as a symbol wasn't developed until the 1780s. And yeah, you'll have like some kooks try and like connect the Masons to the Templars, but it's more of a mythologizing. And you have people like Albert Pike, who, you know, he'll spin all this esotericism and then he'll create his own rite. But in terms of actual like what Rudyard Kipling will have done and what most blue lodges do, masonry is about brotherhood. It's not about deep esotericism.
Would you say that by and large the Freemasons have been a force for good in the world?
Well, I can go down the list of all of the rulers that have been Masons and all of the liberal revolutionaries of the early 19th century and of the French Revolution, yada, yada, yada. But on the ground level, it's a fraternity where mostly veterans and civil servants and adventurers are able to identify each other and have camaraderie across the world and across borders. So to the average man, yes, it's a force for good, and I highly recommend it. But yeah, you can easily connect dots to the rich and powerful creating their own lodges and doing ill.
So something like the French Revolution would get pinned on Freemasons.
It's more of a vector. It was used more of as a vector for French revolutionaries to meet each other and network. Like as an actual platform, it's just, you know, rather wealthy, upper middle class and aristocratic guys, you know, they go hang out once a week or once a month. And as a vector, if you have all of these upper middle class types and revolutionaries, you know, fomenting revolution, it's a great vector to actually infiltrate and use to your advantage, which is how it was used. Mm. So if you have clubhouses for the rich and powerful, and the rich and powerful are planning a revolution, you know, there's no better way to network. But as it exists today, it's mostly just WASP boomers getting away from their wives once a week to smoke cigars and talk like philosophy and business.
Who was the American president who, in the 1800s, who like opposed having central banks in America?
That's Andrew Jackson. I believe he was a Mason too.
Yeah, he. I think he was a high-ranking Mason. And this is interesting, because if rumors about
we had all sorts of. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say because. If he was in cahoots with a certain other kind of elite group who did want to establish the Federal Reserve and, you know, usury and central banks and all that, like if they are in cahoots together, it does make you wonder why he was taking bullets to prevent that happening. I've always thought that was a strange thing.
Like, I saw a great quote from Theodore Roosevelt, who was a Mason. He said, you know, him and his groundskeeper were both Masons. He said in this letter that, you know, in public life, he would never associate with his groundskeeper, but at the lodge, his groundskeeper was his worshipful master, who's like, who he has to pay his respects to in private. So the idea is, at the actual lodges, it doesn't really matter your actual social position. What matters is, you know, paying honors to your meritocratic leaders and brothers, irrespective of social class. So, on the small hat tribe question, I'd say that this is vastly overblown. But that's a rather edgy topic that I'd rather not get into.
It gets that would have to be for like an official Morgcast or something where we can get into that a bit. But I did always wonder the strange thing about Andrew Jackson, who I think was a high ranking Mason, and he like literally taking bullets to prevent the establishment of like the Federal Reserve and that kind of thing, like, in America.
The point is that there are no high ranking Masons. Like, once you become a Master Mason, there is nothing above that. And you're supposed to treat other Master Masons as your brothers. Right. And so when you're on the frontier, you know, I've seen stories where, you know, during the American Revolution, you know, an American was captured by Indians and he's about to get tortured and scalped. But he does like a Masonic symbol, a Masonic British officer saves him from being executed and scalped. Or like brothers on the battlefield in the Civil War, they see another Mason and they have to pay special attention to him just as their fraternal brother. Like, that's how it is in real life.
I mean, in Man Who Would Be King, early on, there's, I forget what it happens actually, but the Rudyard Kipling goes along to try and get them off on some charges for something that they have done. And when asked why, the British official, he says, "Well, what's your interest in this? Why do you want to do it?" And he says, "Because they're Freemasons." So so if people are kind of pulling strings and manipulating systems, so that because here's the problem: if somebody is doing something horrible, and then they call in a few favors from others and Masons, that means that, say, politicians are just going to walk around scot-free.
Like, I can see the vector there. I can see the vector there. But the idea is people that join have to believe in God. Atheists are not allowed to join unless you're French. You know, French lodges have always been trouble. You have to believe in God. You have to be an upright, upstanding citizen. So you can't really commit felonies or do anything to embarrass the lodges, and you have to come of your own free will. Like, no one is like it. It's a social club, and you're supposed to help out. Or yes, there were accusations of corruption in the early 1800s in America, which led to the anti-Masonic movement, and gave it a very bad name for about 40 years. So let's just, there are about three different phases of the Masons, right? Like, its establishment in 1717 to the anti-Masonic movement of the early 1800s, right? So that you had the founding fathers, you had the sort of liberal revolutionaries, but yeah, the in-group preference thing and favors led to a lot of doubt and a lot of anti-Masonic sentiment. So it went, so it started to go on to the decline. Then after the Civil War, the American Civil War in the 1860s, a lot of the veterans wanted to feel camaraderie again. So they started up their Masonic lodges as a sort of, not just as a form of camaraderie, but also as a social security, like as a social net, as a financial safety net. Like, you didn't have health insurance and you didn't really have enough money to save up for funerals. So instead of paying for insurance, you paid for Mason dues so that whenever you died, the Masons would cover your funeral costs and would ensure that your family is taken care of. And also, you know, a lot of veterans became Masons. And so if you're in the middle of India and you have nothing to talk about and you see a Mason, you have at least that one thing to talk about. And then it fell into decline during the Great Depression, but then peaked after the Great Depression until the 60s. Just as another form of social safety net and camaraderie among veteran brothers. So that's sort of what it is.
I'm wondering how much of this plays a role in the sort of all the allegations of paedophilia and child abuse in the British political class. And I'm not talking about the grooming gangs, like the Jimmy Savile type stuff and all of these politics. There's all kinds of dark rumors. And the fact is, if the upper echelons are completely riddled with the favors Bank of Freemasonry, I can see why they just never get brought to account. It makes me uncomfortable. I think I'm going to be on the side of, if I was the dictator of England, I'd be running them all out. But I suppose that's, I mean,
elites in their elite clubs doing bad elite things.
Yeah, well, I mean, let me put it this way. So somebody's driving down the street in his car. He's had a few too many, or he's going a little bit too fast. He then like smacks into a little girl. It's his fault. He kills the girl. He goes to court. And then he's going to stand there and like do three pulls on his left earlobe. And the judge is like in the gutter. The judge is also a Mason. So he gets a really light sentence. Is that the kind of thing that goes on?
The Masons themselves have gone out of the way since the first wave of anti-Masonic sentiment. They've gone out of their way to ensure that, well, one of the stipulations of being a Mason is that you follow the laws of your native country. And so controversially, at least American lodges display the American flag in the actual lodges or outside the lodge buildings as just a warning to say, you know, under no circumstances do you break the law or try to bend the law in favor of your brothers, because it's a social club, right? And we do not want anyone to actually commit crimes or cover up crimes, like, period.
Yeah, it reminds me kind of some of the things that I don't know if I can say on YouTube. Dr. McDonald talks about in his books that one difference between European peoples and another group of people who we can't mention and another ethnic groups as well is that we kind of have this morality that we would see somebody who's like of the same ethnic group as us who, you know, did something amoral. This person would be an outsider. Whereas say with, the tribe you can't talk about on YouTube, they would still see someone as like an insider. If this person did something that wider society would see as amoral, if they're still like loyal to the group and they still like make that group more powerful, they would still see this member as like, he'd still be on the ins with that group. And then you can even like use the example of say like blacks, for example. It's very common that there'll be a criminal and he's obviously guilty, but they'll, if there's blacks on the jury, they'll be more likely to try to vote to acquit him because, you know, he's the same group as them. So, I mean, if I can see the problem with that, like, you know, even in the movie that like they're doing a bunch of amoral things, but they think that, well, as long as they're a Mason, we can't do it to them if it's another Mason. I do have some problems with, like, the commitment to this kind of in-group above like a higher morality. You know, maybe that is just something that's like unique within like Europeans as
it's much more of a concept within the Anglosphere, the concept of civil society as being outside of public and private spheres. So civil society, it's not a public government function, and it's not a private business function. It's a function of brotherhood among men. It is churches. It was free societies that ensured that in the case that you died, your community would actually take care of you. And no, it's not a part of the government, and no, it's not a for-profit business. And the problem is that we have lost the concept of civil society and brotherhood among men, which leads to a vacuum that the government has taken over. And it's a concept that is very difficult to wrap your mind around, where government is pretty much everything, or private. Like, could you actually go to your neighbor as a neighbor and ask for him to give you to either take a favor or give a favor? Like, can you actually trust your neighbors? This concept of selfless civil society is just something that we don't actually have very much anymore. And it's a shame. And Masonry has been caught up in a lot of nasty stuff over the years. But I don't think we should eradicate the concept of civil society for purifying the public sphere.
Yeah, it's a question that I'm open to. I haven't decided one way or another, but you know, it's something that I don't know. Maybe I'll look into it more in the future. I actually didn't realize until this week when I started looking into this that there was that classic Simpsons episode, The Stonecutters. That was actually about the Masons. You know, even like Mason means someone who breaks rocks. And like I do like that in that episode that like Mr. Burns is the boss, but he's a lower ranked Mason or Stonecutter rather than like Lenny and Carl, so they can treat him like crap there. or that the mechanic does favors for Homer because he finds out he's a member. I didn't realize until recently that that's what that was satirizing.
Yeah, I mean, Freemasonry grew out of stonemasons guilds, where you know Masons would work on cathedrals, and they'd have business secrets, and they were not exactly literate. But they wanted to keep their meetings private so that no one in the public or private sphere could find out what their business secrets were. And they had to identify each other, so they developed handshakes and symbols. And eventually, you know, be a good and honest businessman and treat your fellow professionals professionally and as brothers turned into an international fraternity. Make of it what you will. And it's evolved over the years.
All right. So I'm going to hit the super chats here. So I've got 20 Australian dollars off Dawn Browning. Hello again there, Dawn. Lovely to see you again. And some little symbol thing, which I don't know what that is. Fritjof Roosevelt for $20. Thank you very much. Says, Rudyard Kipling based his story on the real-life events of Josiah Harlan, who became a king in Afghanistan in the 1930s. There was a great book about it called The Man Who Would Be King, the First American in Afghanistan. Now, funny enough, this is kind of how Closington ended up on the stream, because he was giving me some pointers on the Freemasonry in Man Who Would Be King. And me and Endeavour were like, well, it's an element in the movie, and we don't know much about it, so I ended up just inviting Closington on to kind of give us it all firsthand. And that documentary, I watched that yesterday. I think Endeavour and Closington sent it to me. Have you got any thoughts on that documentary there, Closington?
So the documentary in question was a 45-minute lecture that a mentor of mine actually did, mostly on Josiah Harlan. Harlan was a Mason from America, who went out to India to seek his fortune. He became something of a mercenary for a local Raj, but a very, very well-paid mercenary. But he grew tired of how stagnant life was in civilized India. And after his dog died, he thought to himself, you know, what the hell am I living for? Like, I might as well go out to the far reaches of the frontier and make something of myself. So he became a local warlord in Afghanistan. And the parallels, you know, the parallels are very, very close.
Just a minor correction. This was in the 1830s. Just a minor correction. This was the 1830s, not the 1930s. When Morgoth read it out, he said 1930s.
Oh, all right. Right, so go on then.
Yeah, so there's the Harlan story, but there's also James Brooke, who in the movie, and I think in the book they mention Brooke twice, and in the movie I think they reference pulling a Sarawak, where this British adventurer showed up to Borneo and pacified the local Chinese pirates and became a Raj, like a minor king in Borneo, in service of a local Khan. So you had these various stories over the years of white adventurers going west and setting up their own little kingdoms in search of profit and adventure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then there's another one. I worked labor over a summer with my grandfather and saw him do business with two men he said were Freemasons. He thought they were a joke and told me to ignore those thoughts of things. I'm from Borough. He means Middlesbrough in the north. That was for £10. Thank you very much. And then Phil Regular, $20. Great work. And that's it. So thanks a lot for that, Phil. So Man Who Would Be King. I mean, the whole kind of element with the free, we kind of went heavy on it here. But it is there and you can't really ignore it. I mean, you were saying it's like the most Masonic movie ever made. And I think I remember watching it when I was growing up, and I realized there was like another layer to it which I didn't really understand, and it makes your mind tick over as to what it all means, like the weird little things they come out with, like what is it, like on the level and on the square or something, like and you're like, well, oh, and then there's like this kind of code where I'm looking for a widow's son and all of this sort of stuff. And so when I was watching it growing up, I didn't really understand it. So it adds another layer of mystique to the movie, if you like. But it's a fantastic film. And it's kind of a gem. I mean, especially when you think that Rudyard Kipling got kicked out of Masons for being so like blunt about it all. But any parting shots, lads?
I'll just finish by saying it's a great adventure film. It makes you laugh. It makes you cry. It's exciting. It's sad. It's funny. And it just has such a great cast. Christopher Plummer, Michael Caine, Sean Connery. Such a great soundtrack. Such a great setting. It's a fantastic adventure film. And I can see why it was so highly requested. So definitely worth a watch.
All right, Closenton, any parting shots?
I absolutely love this film, mostly as an old Hollywood epic, where you have hundreds upon hundreds of extras, you have all these real-life sets that were built, you have all these diverse locations in a remote part of the world. It really brings to mind sort of the old pulp fiction short stories of Solomon Kane and Conan the Barbarian, but with the aesthetic of British imperialism and sort of sprinklings of masonry that really populate the world. They really make it feel lived in. Like every single scene, you know, you're either being battered by the elements or you hear the local horn players, or you hear local chatter, and you never see that today. Like you always have these sort of passive mobs of people in films where you have hundreds of extras, but it never makes an impression on you. But in this film, you can really feel the value and the weight of the environment. And you also feel the real camaraderie of these two guys. And you really only have like four or maybe five main characters. So you have this epic film and scope, but you have a very personal rise and fall, lie reveal story that I really appreciate.
I mean, when I was a younger man, me and my mate went to Morocco, like the backpacking in the hinterlands as well. And this was before 9/11. And it was wild. It was absolutely wild. And we wanted to get like a camel and all of this. And heading to the Sahara Desert. This is a story for another time, but I remember that we were kind of inspired by Man Who Would Be King. You know, like we were like, you know, life is to be lived. The world is there to be explored and all of this kind of thing. But that kind of went wrong. Morocco was horrific, I have to say. Right, so thanks for tuning in, everybody. And Endeavor, what we've got next month, do you know yet?
Haven't decided yet. I have a couple options, but I'm trying to get some variety in, because a lot of the films we do are this kind of genre, the historical epics, which are my favorite, as everyone knows. But, you know, I'm just trying to think of like how, some ways that we can change it up. But I still have a huge list of stuff. Haven't decided yet, but
I will say, like, the trip to Morocco, like, did play a role in like how I began to think about politics and things like that. It was in itself a sort of demystifying. But I'm gonna call it a day there, folks. Enjoy a Saturday night. Nip into the beer garden, if you're in England, it's lovely weather. And I'll catch you next time.